a highly effective mathematics teaching. And so tune in. It's a live and responsive thing. We could record this and then you could watch it later, but where's the fun in that? We want to get you involved in real time, be part of the whole thing. So we are on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn. So mostly on Twitter. So just reply to this tweet that you see with the video, and we'll try and get you in when the moment's right. So yeah, we'll crack on with the introductions with a lovely panel here of six we've got right now. Let's start off with myself, Atul. I tutor both primary and secondary, some alternative as well, homeschooling, adults, etc. So off to, let's go with you, Helen. Yeah.
I'm also a tutor. I tutor primarily GCSE and A-level with a few of the younger ones, trying to get themselves ready a little bit earlier as well. And I'm based in North Wiltshire.
Great. Karen?
Hi, I'm Karen. I've been teaching secondary maths for 25, 26 years now. Year 7 all the way up to upper 6 further maths, so cover the full range.
Great. Your first Math Chat Live, I think. So welcome. Welcome to it.
Thank you.
And Jill?
So I'm Jill. I'm based on the Buckinghamshire Berkshire borders. I taught year 1 through to year 6 in primary schools for about 15 years. The smallest school had 103 children. The largest one had 1,800, which was quite a contrast. And I now freelance supporting schools and teachers to develop their maths teaching and do quite a lot of work with my local maths hub as well.
That's great experience. And again, welcome to Maths Chat Live, your first episode
as well. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Tom?
Hi everyone, I'm Tom. I'm a local authority maths advisor in Cambridgeshire. I've been doing this job for nearly 6 years. Before becoming a maths advisor, I worked in a junior school in the West Midlands, a primary school in Southwest London, and a through international school in Thailand. So yeah, broad range of experience working with children of varied ages and starting points.
Brilliant. Really good experience, and welcome to your first episode of Maths Chat Live as well. Talking about the international thing, well, I believe our main host is international, based in Spain, and over to you, Stuart.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. So my name's Stuart. I've been involved in maths teaching for 17 years now, worked in a variety of different schools in Scotland and also internationally in Spain, where I live now. I was head of maths for 6 years, research lead, head of learning and teaching, and I currently work as part of the maths team, as a maths educator for Complete Maths. And I'm delighted to be on the panel again. This is the second time I've been on Maths Chat Live, and I'm just in awe of the amount of experience and knowledge across this panel tonight. So I'm really looking forward to a good discussion.
Brilliant. Yeah, it is a very, very good, very broad range of experience. So, yeah, we've got lots of prompts, I think. Do you want to kick off with your main prompt and we'll
take it? Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think this edition of Maths Chat Live has come off the back of a workshop that I presented at a recent Complete Maths Maths Conf in Gloucester. And really, I think, Atul, you're just trying to apologise for not actually coming to the session and going to see something else at that time. So this is really just a chance to dig into some of the things that we spoke about in that that session. And it was titled Highly Effective Teaching and Thinking About the Big Picture. And really the reason for that was because I feel that recently at a number of conferences, you find workshops that are really quite focused and perhaps not niche, but very specialised. So we had workshops on backward fading, which is fascinating and there's a really rich topic. But it's also quite narrow in terms of the big picture of teaching and structured variation grids, really fascinating and powerful, but again, quite focused. And I really just wanted to try and step back and try and have a look and see if we could come up with a shared description of, you know, what highly effective teaching in mathematics looked like. And I started thinking things like, does it look different to people with different levels of experience and expertise? different stages in their career, perhaps. Is it different in primary and secondary? Is it possible to come up with a framework for what highly effective teaching looks like? I'm sure that there are common themes, but maybe there are little variations here and there. And so I suppose that's the first discussion point, is can we sort of knock around the idea of highly effective teaching in mathematics? What does that actually look like?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to a little conversation we were having in the green room. Is like during lockdown, like many parents had to homeschool their own children, and particularly with the younger children, teaching the earliest ideas is actually the most difficult of all. And a lot of maths teachers also had their younger children. Helen was mentioning that you have your three young children, and you are teaching them, I believe, number bonds. And if you can just elaborate on that, and then we can sort of take over that.
Yeah, my two little terrors, as I call them. When we first went to lockdown, my eldest was a reception, just started at school, and so we were on the real, real basics of number bonds to 10. Eventually, once we got through to lockdown 3, or whichever lockdown we were in at that point, in year 1, we were on number bonds to 20, and using those skills. And actually, for me as a secondary specialist, having to switch my brain down to that level to something that's so instinctive for me. 2 + 3 = 5. It just is. I can see it on my fingers. It's drilled into my brain after however many years of doing this, 30-something now, of age, not years of teaching. But having to figure out how to explain it to my 5-6-year-old at the time was just, how do I do that? That's not something I've got experience in. And we were saying that actually we all know the maths at that level. There are very few of us that don't understand a primary level of maths. I think this was Jill you were saying. But actually how to teach that level of maths, whole different ball game, and really needs some understanding of how they learn at that age as well. So, yeah, the big picture is definitely helpful. I've got more of an understanding now of where they come from. And hopefully by the time they get to me at 15, 16, however old they are when they start working with me, is quite a dramatic difference in what they can do, but knowing where they've come from helps to inform where we go with it next.
I chose to move from teaching year 6 to year 1 for exactly that reason. I've got struggling year 6 learners, and I couldn't work. I wanted to know what had they missed. So I found myself in a year 1 classroom, and I had the classic experience that lots of Key Stage 1 teachers will recognise, where I was introducing the children to the idea of subtractionist finding the difference. So I said, okay, 7 subtract 2. What's the difference between 7 and 2? And of course, they all said 2's got a curly top and 7's got a flat top and 2 sits on a base, at which point let's give up and go home. There's no answer to that because they were absolutely right.
I think one of the difficulties of thinking about how you're going to teach pre-primary as well is because we always talk about the curse of knowledge, don't we? We forget what it was like to not know. Well, of course you're not remembering the stuff you learned when you were 3, 4, 5. How did you learn that? But the principles of learning it are still relatively the same. Your teacher needs to relate it to something you're familiar with. They need to break it down into those small steps so you can experience it and try it out and have that kind of productive struggle and those kind of things. But at that stage, you're learning the most kind of elementary structures of composition. So, you know, as a teacher, you're thinking, okay, I want to talk about subtraction as a reduction model or as a finding the difference model. But these children, they don't even know what takeaway is without thinking about pizza or chips, right? So I've got to be really careful of my language. I've got to be really careful of my examples. But I also need to give them some helpful non-examples so they don't create these massive overgeneralizations. But I reckon that pretty much applies throughout, wouldn't you say? You know, those are core elements that we bring in regardless of the age of the stage of the children's development.
Yeah, I remember I went to Bearings in one of the virtual math comps. Can't remember which one it was, can't remember who the speaker was. It was a couple of months ago, so my brain has discarded that bit of knowledge. But the person that was doing it was doing odd one outs with bearings. So he gave 4 examples, and one of them was a bearing with all the details, 3 digits, measured from north, measured clockwise. And the others weren't, but you had to sort of recognise, well, why isn't that a bearing, a non-example? And I think that's the first time I'd actually kind of come across that thought of doing, well, this isn't what it is, to make it really clear. This is, this isn't.
I find this quite interesting because I teach at a selective school, and there's definitely some of the descriptions there for some of our students would be too basic an introduction, even for some of like the more complicated stuff, because they pick it up so quickly. So although you've got a basis, what you're saying would be highly effective teaching, you'd want to pare it down quite a lot for some of the students who've got a quicker uptake, because they would be feeling like the bearings I've run out, be like, okay, yeah, I've got it. I don't need to do 15 of those. I just need to do one, and I now know what a bearing is. Or maybe I don't even need to do one because your explanation of what a bearing is enough for me to know what I'm doing. And I was wondering whether you sort of starting with this is highly effective teaching, and then as you sort of get more specialised, you might be honing down how much of it you do.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a really interesting point, Karen. It definitely links to something that I've been thinking about a lot, and that it is that really effective teaching is fluid, and it's responsive, and it's adaptive. And I think, you know, that's what sets expert teachers apart, is their ability to take in the information that's in front of them and modify and adapt. And I've come to think now that, you know, teaching is like, I don't want to put a number on this, but it's like 80% gathering info and then deciding. And I suppose we're looking at sort of responsive teaching in there. But I'll pick up on a few things that came across there. I think two, maybe three people talked about language and the vocabulary that's used. And it's so important that we are thinking carefully about new terms, the language that we want to use, how it might be misinterpreted by pupils. And again, that's something that I think we pick up over time, quite often through experience, by making the mistakes, you know, talking about takeaway and then getting the reference to the fish and chip shop or wherever that might be. You know, so that's an interesting thing, because if we sort of learn what to say and when to say it and how to say it over time, you know, do we just expect all beginning teachers to just stumble through the same sort of, you know, the same sort of quagmire that we did and make all those mistakes? Or can we do more for beginning teachers to help them about that, so they can maybe save themselves a bit of time and maybe focus on something else? Or do we do more? Do we do enough for new teachers?
Probably there's something about the capacity that anybody has to take on additional knowledge at any one point is in terms of working memory overload. Because I remember the last NQT I mentored saying to her in the summer, you know, ending her first year of teaching, do you remember last September, all you could think about was doing the register and the lunch register and pressing send before the scary lady from the office came to ask where it was? And that was her whole working memory shot. And then once she got the hang of that, it was, what time do I need to get my class moving so we're not the ones doing the walk of shame into assembly? And of course, the longer she was teaching for, the more routine she automated, and therefore the more working memory she had available to her to be responsive, to read the room, to respond to the children, and to move away from what David Berliner in his paper on stage theory of teaching talks about. You know, new teachers are very inflexible and need to stick to the plan. And I remember that when I was an NQT in a Catholic school, lovely people, love nothing better than dropping a hymn practice for an impromptu mass at about 10 minutes notice. And I'd be there saying, no, I can't do this because my math plan says. And of course, as you get more experience, you become more able to respond to that kind of thing.
So I would say, from a secondary point of view, that's not necessarily more experience of teaching. It's more experience of teaching specific topics. So from a further mathematics A-level teaching point of view, when you might only teach something once every 5 years, I'm still been known to stand there with my worked example in my hand, making sure I know what the next step is when I'm stood at the board, because, you know, I'm doing a piece of A-level math, further A-level mathematics I haven't done for 5 years. And although I've worked through it at home that night or the night before, I'm still a little bit, I'm not as perfect as this as if you asked me just to throw a fractions question on the board that I know will challenge the students at an appropriate level. So I can deal with the management of the classroom, and I know what I want to do to teach the students, but actually I'm still using a lot of my working memory to do the actual mathematics in the room.
And that's because it's maths that you are less familiar with teaching. So it's it's about the level of experience with that topic.
Is that... So experience with the topic rather than experience of teaching generally. Yeah, so in terms of, like, yeah, 20 years teaching, but only taught it five times, just because, you know, you don't hit the rotation of teaching further mathematics that many times in your teaching career, that'll, to be fair. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I've certainly been in that position, and I don't think there's anything at all, you know, wrong with having your example on a piece of paper in your hand there. And you're obviously saying there's the maths that you're doing, but I think what you're also doing when you're doing the maths is you're trying to think ahead and think about maybe questions for the class and think about the misconceptions. So it's not just a case of you're solving a maths problem. There's so much more going on. In fact, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And it's all the rest of this, as we talked about, the signals and the cues and the decisions and the information that you're gathering and processing that's going on at the same time. Tom, you mentioned a couple of things which I thought were really interesting, you know, new material being presented in small steps. And you talked about the examples and the non-examples. And obviously Karen kind of came in there and said she thinks it's about a balance and it's about getting that right. Do you think that, you know, there's any difference between primary and secondary in terms of that sort of experience that pupils might get in terms of the small steps? Is there a sort of trajectory of maths expertise that pupils are on as they go through school such that further up into secondary they don't need so many examples, they don't need such small steps? Or is this something that is applicable across the whole of schooling?
I think the idea of the small steps approach is applicable, but we have to consider that with maths being hierarchical, some of the things that are being introduced in secondary and higher, the children have had experience of several times over. So that might influence the size of the small step, like how small is the step? And partly, one of the things we need to be thinking about when the size of the small step is, how big can I make it before it's no longer possible for me to check the children are staying up, like keeping up with me, in terms of like checking for understanding? If I'm giving them too much, it's really hard for me to see which bit of it have they kept up with and which bit haven't they kept up with. So, yeah, I think the idea probably permeates through, though the size of the step might depend on the type of content that's being introduced, how it relates to prior learning and those kind of things. But I think the commonality will be the importance of the checking for understanding. Is everyone still with me at this stage, or have I gone way too far? You know, have I just put too much in front of them that some are nodding along with me, sometimes even the highest attainers, but they've just got a really good mask of going, yeah, I know what you're talking about, because they're confident that they'll figure it out later and they don't want to show themselves up on the carpet. So yeah, I think the concept probably fits, but it has to be tied with that checking for understanding.
Mm-hmm. I really like that small incremental steps idea, which is actually a mathematical idea as well. We use it in calculus, isn't it? Even the word delta is for those like tiny increments. And I don't know if any of you read Atomic Habits by James Clear, where he talks about the idea that it is like very, very small, tiny improvements that when you compound over many years, and it's the same in learning anything. So I try and get my students to do 5 a day Corbett maths every day, and one of the things that I tell the parents is that actually, sort of like going to the gym, you won't notice any changes in the first month, but if you stick at it for like 6 months, there'll be quite big changes. 1 year, fairly big changes. 2 years, dramatic changes. And that's where the skill also comes in for teachers, is knowing what those incremental changes are. And I really like the way you're saying like 80% of it is measurement. For me, like in one-on-one tutoring, almost all of it feels like measurements in the first few minutes of the session. So it's measurement, tweakings, increment.
I just to add to that, I think it is, because my work now is supporting teachers with their development. And it's the same idea in terms of where they're thinking about their habitual practice in the classroom. You know, so if I'm trying to help someone reflect on how they check for understanding, since that's what we're talking about, I can't ask them to think about all the different ways they check for understanding. I need them to think intentionally about, okay, so when I ask the children to show me their whiteboards, for example, can I gather more information by slowing down the routine? You know, I refer to it as Mexican wave style, like this table show me, this table show me, this table show me, this table show me. Asking the teachers to change from the 3-2-1 everybody show to that habit is a very small step, an incremental change. And they have to deliberately try and build that into their practice to notice the effect of doing so. But when they do, they're changed then as a teacher. But that change is easier to do earlier within the teacher's career. You know, if you're trying to support someone with that change and they've been teaching for a very long time and they've always asked the children to, you know, 3-2-1, show me your boards. For them, it's a harder change to make because I'm asking them to change a habit that's existed for a very long time that they might have done thousands, if not tens of thousands of times.
I think that's a really important point. I've been working with some groups of teachers recently on the whole idea of ensuring children answer in full sentences and not accepting one word answers. And that is a really, really, really hard habit to change. And I do a whole CPD session where, you know, I model it, they answer, we practice, we talk about why it's important. Then a bit later, I ask them another question and they come back with a one word answer. And I sit there and go, at which point, oh, forgot. And it just needs so much practice. And I always relate it to trying to change the handwriting grip of a Key Stage 2 child. No chance. Because it's so deeply embedded.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, to hear you talking about habits, because I think as teachers, we couldn't function if we didn't have our habits and everything that's automated about what we do. So much so that I think, you know, experienced teachers probably don't even consciously really think about some of the things that are happening. It's a subconscious process. And so when you get a new teacher, perhaps observing, and you sometimes see like new teachers get put in, go and watch Tom, go and watch Karen. You know, what are they actually looking at? Are they able to see the things that are going on? And I think the thing that really sort of hit this home for me was at one of the schools I worked at, I was involved in after schools sports. And, you know, I can kick a football and run around a track sort of thing. But I was out with the PE teachers, and the level of detail that they can watch and they can see and they can observe in a pupil's movement, the way they're passing a ball, the way they're positioning themselves in the field, I'm completely oblivious to all of this stuff. And that really sort of hit home to me how I'm just a novice coming out here and watching these sporting activities. And I think that's probably applicable to new teachers watching experienced teachers. So you almost think, how can new teachers get the most out of observing a more experienced colleague?
That's something I've been doing quite a bit of work on with the teachers that I work with, because you don't know what you don't know. And an experienced teacher will always make it look easy. And when I worked in the really, really big school, we had lots of overseas trained NQTs, and I would go in and model teaching for them. And whenever we could, a colleague would go along as well to stand at the back of the room and say, why do you think Jill did that? Or have a look at how she does this. And it really helped focus attention on the things we wanted them to notice. But not many schools have got the luxury, A, of releasing a teacher to watch teaching in the first place, certainly in a primary context, and releasing a second one as well. So I've been working on the idea of a two-column lesson plan where I'll plan out beforehand, this is what I'm going to do at each stage of the lesson. And then the second column is the rationale. So this is why I've chosen to put it in there, and this is what I want to get out of it. And I use that as a way of trying to direct the observer's attention to what I want them to notice. And then I use three question prompts at the end where it depends on the observation focus. But the first question would be, jot down all the ways I do whatever it is, you know, get all the children talking, use representations. What's the impact on the children, and what are you going to do as a result? And that three question structure then forms the basis of our discussion after the lesson. And it's not perfect, but it's the best way I've found yet of keeping attention on what I want them to notice, not isn't that a lovely English display?
I think that sounds really useful. And I think I see how that would work in secondary as well. And I'm sitting there listening to that, trying to work out how you could build in them being able to comment on the responsive teaching that you don't know is going to happen, then you haven't put in your lesson plan. I'm trying to think what sort of questions could you put for them to like answer, you know, at the point where you suddenly ask, you know, seven more questions on the mini whiteboards than you were expecting to, and what was special about those seven questions that you asked? What made you go off on that tangent and ask those questions? What did you spot?
Well, I think, you know, those question prompts at the end, my first question would be, note down every time I do something that's not on the plan.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've done it. That would be the way I'd do it anyway. But it comes, for me, it comes back to what is the focus of the observation, and the tighter the observation focus, the more likely it is that an observer will get what you want. And I've been doing quite a lot of work on 10-minute observations, because in a primary school, getting out of your classroom, even without COVID, is practically impossible. But for 10 minutes, you're more likely to find somebody, you're nodding, Tom. So you could leave your class doing some fluency practice for 10 minutes while somebody else is in there. And if the person you're going to watch has got a really clear focus for what they are exemplifying for you, then you can get a huge amount out of 10 minutes.
Well, I've come to the realisation after doing this job as an advisor for 6 years that after about 5 or 6 minutes, the observer already has too much to think about. If we genuinely want them to reflect on their practice and how they're going to do it, I think, you know, the 5 to 10 minutes is probably that kind of golden window before there's now too much to cloud what they're thinking about. Because the way in which we use examples and we check for understanding and those kind of things changes throughout a lesson. And if I want them to think about changing something in their practice, it's probably only something that happens within a certain part of their lesson. Or, as Karen said, when you respond to something that happens in a lesson, and that might happen at different stages. So, yeah, you know, my model of team teaching with teachers, particularly early career teachers, is when I help them plan, I help them focus on a specific part of their plan. Not the whole lesson anymore. I'm just getting them to think about it. So we can have a really detailed conversation about that part of it. And then when we team teach, they hand over control to me for that part of the lesson. And every now and then you break the fourth wall and you go, you know how I said, well, we were going to do that? Well, I've just noticed this, so we're not going to do that. Scrap that, because doing this for the children's more important. So yeah, breaking the fourth wall every now and then is really important in that team teaching model. But yeah, it relies on quite a lot of release time, you know, the time to pre-plan and talk about the lesson in advance, to share practice, and then to go through it afterwards, you know, and all of that, and then follow it up later. So you have to be really blessed with the amount of time you've got to work with the person, to work that incrementally. But the payback is huge. But the same is true with guided group work with children, isn't it? You know, we're going to focus on this thing. I'm going to show you in this much detail, and we're going to do a lot of practice together, and that's all I want you to think about today. I could show you way more, but you'll forget it by the time we're on geography after break, or RE at the end of the day, or whatever it's going to be. So, yeah, again, that idea of incremental change kind of permeates through there, doesn't it? Teacher development and guided group work, so...
I really like that idea. I'm going to go away and think about that one. Even only because I quite often get asked to demonstrate in schools I go into, and I prepare in such detail because I don't want to look stupid and I want them to get a lot out of it. It takes far too long. And I'm thinking, you're absolutely right. They'd get just as much out of me mumbling for 10 minutes. And that would mean a lot less prep.
Yeah. Well, and everyone wants you to do it to their class because they're listening to you, and you go, oh, I use this routine. Like, yeah, try doing that with my class on a Wednesday afternoon after we've had the... So they really want to see you do it with their children and prove that it's possible. And when you do, they're like, oh, yeah, that does work. Maybe I should be slightly less cynical.
That's why I do it, because so often teachers say, oh, I get it now. Now I've seen it, I know what you mean.
You know, I'm just thinking as we're talking there, the eternal challenge of making time to do these things. And so often the things that are going to make the most powerful sort of longer term important changes are the ones that seem to get bumped down the agenda and hidden behind sort of immediate busyness. I can't help wonder, but if there's some sort of video solution to this, if there's some way that we can use recordings of, you know, a short session of perhaps Tom using his mini whiteboards or whatever, and then you know, the early career teacher can look at this when they've got a window of time, maybe make some notes, come back to you and say, right, I noticed 3 minutes in you did this. Why did you do this? I think you did this because of that reason. I wonder if there's, you know, scope to get...
We do a bit of that. Yeah, we do a bit of that, Stuart. 2012, 2013, the NCETM made 90 short videos of teachers teaching primary lessons. And yeah, for my sins, I did one of the algebra ones for year six. But within there, there are lessons, I think they go as far as year 10, maybe. And you're watching teachers, they teach a bit of the lesson, and then there's commentary of what they did in that bit of the lesson and what they're going to do next. And they're really useful to go through with a teacher, because you can say, right, we're going to watch this video. I want you to look out for this thing. You watch it, you can pause it, you can watch it again if you want to. But yeah, even then the teacher's like, well, that's okay with that class when you've got a room full of adults and a camera crew. No child's going to misbehave there. So yeah, there's pros and cons of it.
You know, it's just as relevant for tutors as well, actually. And one of the things I'd like to do with parental permission is that I should record bits of online, because I work on screen. I've been doing that for 6 years already, so I could record an actual snippet of a session and then do bits of commentary on why that decision was made and some of the history of that particular duty. Because so yeah, it's the same thing when you're talking about, well, that classroom is different to this classroom, and in some ways it is, because you know the history of your pupils much, you know what you've done with them and you know what they respond to. So I think that would be quite a important part of it as well in that commentary, but hopefully that with that technology and everything, that's more possible now. Yeah,
we have some software at our place that we use to record lessons, and you can do it in several ways. So you can do it through your phone. You can have two cameras set up, so you can have one on you and one on the students, or you can also record the computer screen. So if we're using interactive whiteboards, you can record one camera on you and then one camera, which is the screen share, which means you've got a really good copy of your board, and plus what you're doing in terms of waving your arms and stuff as well. And then you can send clips. So it's all stored safely behind your login, but you can send clips to other people within the school. So you can just clip out a sort of 2-3 minute section and go, here's a bit where I was doing that. You know, this is what I was talking about in the department meeting or things like that, which is definitely... it's definitely got sort of some uses in terms of time and everything like that. So,
sometimes you have to work around establishing sort of norms and a safety for people that they were prepared to video themselves.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the fact that it's behind the login, so nobody else on the senior, nobody else can access it. Only you can access it with your login. So unless you share the video with somebody else within the school, nobody else is seeing it. So I think everyone in the school was quite happy that they had full control. And you can't rip the videos off the system. You can't download the videos from the system because there might be students on it and everything like that. So it all feels very safe from a nobody is looking at what I'm doing. I am making the choice to share this. I'm recording it for my benefit. I can watch it back if I want to, and I can share any clips I want with people I want to.
That's great. Karen, just to pick up on one of the things you said, I had to point this out to a teacher the other day, the waving our arms around, the role of gesture, particularly with those abstract ideas we're trying to teach children, is really important. You know, I was with an early career teacher and we went to watch two more experienced teachers teach the same thing. So we basically saw the same input in one lesson and then the next lesson. And the second class just seemed to get it much more intuitively than the first. And the early career teacher said to me, what's happened there then? They basically described it in exactly the same way, with exactly the same explanations and those kind of things. Why did the second class get it? And the teacher was talking about augmentation, and they were doing this. You know, they're talking about different quantities and combining them together, and aggregation and all these kind of things. But she was using hand gestures. I think she was talking about augmentation like that and aggregation like that, and the children seeing the difference between it. And she was like, oh, totally get it. You know, one was kind of pointing, but the other was using real gesture to show the coming together of two parts, you know, that side of composition. I thought, brilliant. You know, great example there. But if there wasn't an observer in the room, those teachers might never have known what had happened in their rooms. They could have talked in the staff room afterwards and went, how did your lesson go? Oh, mine was terrible. And the other person's thinking, well, I'm not going to tell you how great my lesson was then.
But then, I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Like, say, you know, somewhere is there, there's some notes somewhere that go, you know, if you're teaching this, we recommend you wave your arms around. You know, and actually, if you're a new teacher and you're teaching it and you're holding on to some notes or a bit of paper because for safety, or you've got your board pen because, you know, you're nervous and you're like clicking the lid off, you're not going to move your arms to show it. And then, you know, actually just by being someone who's a little bit more nervous in the classroom, you're not teaching it as effectively.
Yeah, that maths advisor's in again. Hold on to your notes.
Yes.
I think that goes back to something you were saying earlier, that at the start of your career, your working memory is overloaded by just the act of being there and getting to the end of the lesson in one piece. And it's as you get more experience, you are able to take on extra things like the use of gesture.
I think the same is probably true, Jill. Do you think for anxiety? You know, when we work with those children who've got that anxiety, you think that maybe part of their working memory is caught with the, I hope I don't get this wrong. I hope people don't see me make mistakes here. You know, is part of their attention divided to the just stay under the radar, just, you know, don't get caught out? And is that holding them back from participating in the same way that other maybe more confident peers might? What do you reckon?
I think that definitely, but also the fear of what if I get asked something I can't answer. Yeah. When I did my primary math specialism, my family laughed for about a fortnight because they remembered the row I'd had with my dad about my maths homework every single week all the way through secondary school. And you can see it with children, can't you? You know, the shutters come down. And at that point, that you're just throwing words at a wall. And there's a real art of knowing when enough is, you're not going to get any further, so quit. Come back to it later. And I think you're right, Tom, that's a huge issue for children.
That non-verbal communication, that hand-waving thing, I've watched like every one of the Math Chat Live episodes, and like the first 2 minutes I'm just doing that. But that's part of our pedagogy, that's part of our, it's a non-verbal communication, the voice tone, your facial expressions, and that communicates like your confidence or your groundedness in where you are as a performer as well. Like, you know, if you go on stage and you're like really grounded, and in classroom teaching is very similar. You're out there and you're performing, and that and the converse is you're anxious about being on stage, then the audience also picks up on it. But that, like I've told this to online tutors, like pretty much from the outset, I always use camera because that, like my hand waving, my voice and my facial expressions, they're all part of my teaching pedagogy. They're all part of who I am and how I present the information. So that's such an important thing to be able to articulate to someone else. Actually, that's why I'm doing it. That's what it means.
Sorry, Karen, on you go.
Well, I was just thinking, coming back to the point that you were making at the start about how can we help newer teachers become highly effective. It's like some of the things you're going to struggle to support them with because for safety reasons, they want to be at the front of the classroom behind the teacher's desk, whereas actually you would be more effective in a classroom if you're prepared to wander around a bit because you can control the behaviour a bit better by positioning yourself. And is it, are there some things that you're sort of, they come with experience, but there are what are the things that we could do to help them that don't come with experience? I mean, is there any things make highly effective teachers that don't come with just the experience of teaching? I think that, you know, that would be some really key things to be able to identify, wouldn't it?
I'd like to chime in with a very similar question that Priya has, which is very similar to yours, Karen. I'll just put it out there as well. If effective teaching comes from deep understanding of the concepts at hand and skills to communicate it, then does the years of experience matter?
I think...
Go on, Jill.
I was just thinking about misconceptions, and I remember being told years ago, when a teacher's been in a year group for a year or two, they know what the children won't be able to do because they couldn't do it last year and they couldn't do it the year before. So maybe we should teach it differently. And when I was working at the really big school, that was something I really tussled with. How can I, as the experienced non-teaching maths lead whose role was to support all these overseas-trained NQTs, how can I inform, help them know what the misconceptions they're going to face are? And I didn't ever come up with an answer to it, but it is that whole process of preparing to teach. What are the children going to find tricky in this lesson? So what explanations, models, images do I need to include in order to address those misconceptions? And if I know in advance what they're going to be, I can plan for it. But if I don't know that they're going to tell me the difference between 7 and 2 is about a curly top and a flat top, I can't prepare.
I think the point I was going to say is if you want to help fast track teachers' understanding of where to go with introducing something, it might sound counterproductive, but one of the things they need to know is what was taught before it. When this topic was taught last time, how was it taught? How long ago was it taught? What's the children's experience of it? Because if you're assuming that every child remembers what was taught last time and you're adding on to it, you need to know that as well. You can't assume that what you're teaching them is brand new to them. So, yeah, some of the things I do with supporting teachers with planning often involves familiarising them with the prior year group's content. What were the core ideas? How might they have been represented? How might the teacher have tackled any misconceptions as they arise? Because there's a really good chance that some of the children have got shaky foundations in those areas. So if we can do some form of pre-topic diagnostic to find out whether children have got any gaps or misconceptions in those areas far enough in advance of when we do our planning and start that unit, that can really help them out. I think if teachers are figuring that out live in the moment and they're an experienced teacher, I don't know how they get through that and feel like the lesson was a success. So the sooner you can find that information out in advance, where the children are coming from, how they learned this stuff last time, how they describe it to a friend, those kind of things, the better informed you're going to be in the way that you introduce new things to them.
One of the things that you were mentioning in that seminar when you first first delivered it, Stuart, at Gloucester, you gave the example of teaching fractions. And to be fair, we can teach that at very different levels. There's all sorts of different places where it comes into the curriculum. And I have year 10s that still can't handle it, that start with me and they go, how on earth have I done this? But you did the massive map, the sort of, where you connected everything in. So actually, before they do fractions, they probably need a fair understanding of highest common factor and lowest common multiple to be able to handle equivalent fractions and simplifying fractions. So before we get highest common factor and lowest common multiple, we actually need multiple and factor sorted. So actually being able to do that as a topic, breaking it down, and it's something we've started to do recently in a hub for tutors. We've got a STEM hub. Most of the emphasis has been on math so far, but it's breaking it down. What do students need to know before we can encounter the topic that we're going to go to? And with many of these topics, as we've said, with experience, we know where the main misconceptions are going to come up. We've taught for enough years that we know that they're going to struggle with this, or this might not have been explained, or it's not an easy concept to get at year six. So when we teach it in year eight, let's have another look at it and make sure we've got the underpinning stuff sorted before we go on. Today we were talking about simultaneous equations. What do you need to be able to handle simultaneous equations? Negative numbers. Nobody likes negative numbers with the students. They all panic as soon as they see them in an algebra question. But there was also a point about, actually, do we need to understand that if we've got two variables in the simultaneous equation, that means we've got infinite solutions, which, again, when they get later on, you don't necessarily... There is just so much. You could make a massive map, couldn't you, of where everything interweaves together. But there we go. There was another one from MathsConf Gloucester. I'm sure somebody else... That's next week, isn't it, Atul?
Yeah, that's next week.
There we go. That was totally unintentional. If we can... And I guess that's something that we can give to new tutors, new teachers... from our experience is this: if you're about to teach this, this is what they should have done before, when they should have done it, and what understanding they'll have. So assess it, test it, check it out, do it in some fun way or other, find out if they can handle that, because if they can't, then there's no point in taking the next smaller step until they've got that underpinning understanding secure, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It does make perfect sense. And actually, Helen, that slide that you were describing there has proven to be quite popular for something which I think is really a very, very simple idea. In the case of taking a blank piece of A4 and in the middle, putting down the bit of math that you're about to teach, and then in a sort of ring around it, think what are the sort of immediate mathematical ideas that feed into that and sort of connect them up. So like a first level prerequisite, and then look at that ring that you've created and think, well, what feeds into that? Now, I'm not saying necessarily that we have to test and check all those things, but maybe, you know, perhaps we should. But just the process of doing that, I think, really opens up your mind to, wow, there's a lot of kind of existing maths that they've apparently, you know, learned and covered that supports this new idea. And that's just a good point for maybe early careers teachers to think, did I even realise that that web and that network was connected in such a way. And you know, I've been lucky enough to have the sort of experience of getting a class to such a point where I know what they know and I know what they don't know, and we can fill in those gaps and we can try and get a whole group of pupils up to some level of sort of parity, so the whole class is almost at the right point. And then when you come to something like simultaneous equations, Helen, and you've got the, you know, the pupils can substitute, you know that they can, you know, you talked about just negative numbers in there, you know they've got that solid, they can solve linear equations to find the other missing variable. When you know that they've all got all of those components and you go into something like simultaneous equations, teaching that is actually a joy, because there really isn't that much new coming. And if we approach all of math teaching like that, if we can be aware of what the prerequisite knowledge is, if we can check for it, as we said, and if we can fill in those gaps and get our whole class to some level that they're all ready for the new idea, then you can really advance at pace through a lot of maths. And maybe that's what highly effective teaching looks like, but it brings in so many things that we've already talked about. But so much of it seems to be coming back to reading the signals, gathering the information from the pupils, and constantly modifying and making decisions, which it seems like that's something that is tricky to do as an early careers teacher, although there's probably ways that we can try and support that. So, you know, highly effective teaching, it sounds like you know, like a lot of plates are spinning at the same time, in a sense. And you know, sometimes you're focusing on one thing, but at the back of your mind you're consciously planning for something that comes up. And you know, we've obviously got the advantage here of having two people who, you know, work primarily one to one, I think, Atul mostly, and Helen, and then, you know, the rest of the panel here are working one to many. And this one-to-one, I think we probably know, is really a very effective way of teaching and learning, because you're in the moment with that pupil. You're really getting to understand what they need and where they're at and where they struggle with and what sort of representations are sort of making sense for them. I'm just wondering about how much of that is transferable into a classroom. You know, can we try and get almost that magic one-to-one going in a one-to-many environment, or are we always going to really struggle because of those factors?
I think it's a great question. I think a large part of that can be achieved to some extent when introducing something new or continuing a journey of learning in the second or third lesson. Neil Armand describes this as like the box set idea of a curriculum, and we used the previously. You know, when you're watching a box set and before the credits roll, they show you what you need to remember from previous episodes. And something as complicated as Game of Thrones, they might show you something from last series or several episodes ago. And I'm trying to help teachers think about that idea of, before I introduce today's learning objective, let me remind you of the things you're going to need to think about today from last time or from previously. And we might use that approach. And it's that knowing of, are the light bulbs going on of, oh yeah, I remember that model, that representation, or that word, or that kind of stuff. And then that kind of, now, partner A, explain this idea to partner B. Partner B, take notes. Agree? Do you both have a shared understanding of what we mean by that? Now let's come back together. And if they are, we're ready to introduce the learning objective and move on. If not, hold on, which of these ideas do we need to clarify before I introduce something new? So yeah, that kind of idea of a previously, before we go on something new, let's recap these many ideas or these little notes or gestures or whatever it is, and see how ready, you know, check that readiness. And having those kind of partner talk routines can really sort that out for you, as long as the children are carefully paired up and you've got a knowledgeable route around the room of who you need to listen into. But yeah.
There was something else I mentioned in one of the other seminars. There was one on retrieval practice and the four quadrants. And one of the examples was where you could have like just a grid of four questions, one from a topic you did yesterday, last week, last month, last year. And you can, and it was given the example of being able to use that to plan ahead. If you know that you are going to be teaching fractions, well, in your retrieval practice, a session or so before, or getting them as a starter, just literally getting their brains mathematically ready again, put a highest common factor and a lowest common multiple question in there, so that bit has already been retrieved from the deep dark depths of somewhere in the teenage brains and then brought forward so that the next time they got to access it, it's somewhere closer to the front, and you could use that in there. Obviously less of a thing with one-to-one than one-to-many, but it's fascinating how the brain works in that way.
So I was wondering about sort of Stuart's prerequisite map. Do we have a fancy word for it? Is that what we're going for? whether just the words would be enough for the students. So if you actually gave them a copy of it and a pencil and went like, shade in the things on this thing that you think you know you can definitely do, and like, you know, if they saw the word adding fractions, would they know they could definitely do it, or do you need an example just in terms of time constraints? If you've got, you know, your outside ring's got, first ring's got 5 and then your other next ring's got 20 and there's 25 things there, would just asking them to quickly shade be something that's a bit quicker, or is that not enough sparking of things?
You know, that's really interesting, Karen, because you know, I've never said or suggested that should be an exercise for pupils to do, but yeah, a number of people have thought this is a great thing, we could give this to pupils and get them to shade in. So it's sort of it's this thing I've always thought would be a bit of a planning tool for teachers, it seems like people are quite keen to turn it into some sort of self-assessment activity for pupils. And yes, you know, I think you're absolutely right that just having sort of a couple of words that are trying to convey a granule of maths is probably not enough for pupils. In fact, I've always found that you really need to have them do a question before they can accurately say whether they can actually do it or not.
It's
one thing, you know, sort of showing a pupil a question that's, you know, maybe got right angle triangle and a side and an angle and a missing side, and they might recognise, oh, I need some trigonometry here, and they'll think, because it looks familiar, I can do it. But until they actually do the question, I don't think we can accurately say. So if anyone was to do something like that with pupils, I think you've got to have pupils doing the maths before you can make the decision on whether they can do the maths. I think I feel quite strongly about that.
I was listening to you thinking, what if you ask them to add an example to each of those, or a representation of what the question is?
Yeah.
Because that would be a lovely piece of assessment for me as a teacher, because the examples or representations they chose to draw for each of those concepts would tell me a lot about what they knew, wouldn't it?
And what they hadn't learned or had misconstrued. Mm-hmm. You can tell I teach maths and not English. There we go. The bit that they've got the misconception on, if they've represented it wrong, but you can work out why, then that, yeah, lots of information. And I would say that you could shade, but it would be a very broad sweep, overarching, yes, let's use it, but it's not enough detail to take anything.
Yeah,
you could do it to go, most of the class have probably got an idea of what adding fractions is, so let's do a couple of warm-ups to work on it, just as a starter or something, and then it's a broad overview, I guess, isn't it?
Even that, to me, you know, I sort of regret slightly that I put adding fractions at the centre of that slide, because that's too vague. You know, are we proper and improper? Are we mixed numbers? What's going on here? We talked about retrieval practice and we talked about having pupils colour things in, something that I found was really quite effective was a kind of 10-question retrieval quiz where there was a grid on the front of it, and after the pupils did question one, they were to go to the grid and they were to rag assess their confidence with question one. So do the question and then shade in your confidence. So they did that across the whole 10 questions, and then you would get this column of 10 boxes all shaded in. And then I would be able to mark it and give them some feedback. And, you know, they could then colour in a red, amber, green. If they got it right, if they got it catastrophically wrong, it would be red. If there's just a little mistake, it would be orange. It was really interesting to see how, by and large, the boys... and there's no scientific basis to this study other than my own experience, but the boys tended to always overestimate. They would have greens for a lot of things that ended up being red, and the girls, in my experience, tended to be much less confident, and they would put reds as their assessment, but they'd actually get things right. But what was really very interesting was that over time, over weeks and months of doing this, the sort of predicted self-assessment started to really match up with what they actually got. And I think what you're getting there, John Hattie sort of talks about, you know, powerful pupils, powerful learners are those who know what they know and what they don't know. And so, you know, I think that was a really nice little activity to do, and something I would return to I know that self-reported sort of ability is not massively reliable, but it did seem to come in line over time.
Craig Barton talks about getting the students to give confidence ratings, isn't it? So for each one, then give yourself marks out of 5 or 10, and if you got it wrong, then you subtract your confidence score, and if you get it right, you add it. And then, I love that idea. Never tried it with year one for some reason.
So I think Colin Foster was doing some research into that as well, just before the pandemic breaks. Whether he managed to get the data in yet or not, I don't know.
Variation on the idea, Stuart, that I've used with year two and year three in the past. Instead of using 10 questions, maybe 5 or 6, asking the children to rank the questions. So they're on strips of paper or they're movable from I think this is the easiest to I think this is the hardest. And they solve them from their perception of easiest to hardest. And that brings out so much discussion about what were they noticing within the question to make a decision about whether they predict this is going to be complicated or not. So having children as young as 6, 7, 8, having that dialogue around, I think this is going to be more complicated because I can see this is going to have several steps. Whereas that one's a fact I know, so I can put that right at the top up here. Leads to really nice dialogue. I mean, you have to do that kind of thing first with small guided groups to get them used to that type of conversation. You definitely wouldn't go full class with that the first time. Because you want to develop that kind of language and that kind of metacognitive thought. But yeah, a nice variation on the task you described, ranking the questions and then getting the dialogue out of that. Sometimes you don't even need to even try and solve the questions then, just the dialogue around their perceived idea of difficulty can be in it.
Still the idea of the box set approach, because when you were describing it, I thought you were going with the Netflix thing of, you know, at the end of every episode, you get a snippet of what's coming next to make you want to carry on. And can we reclassify lesson planners in that way?
Yeah. I was literally yesterday talking to someone about the having a hinge question before the start of your plenary to go, do we need to recap from today? Or can I do a bit of foreshadowing and say, this is something that's going to come up tomorrow, you know, that kind of thing. And having that live feedback from a hinge question or exit ticket, but not doing it right at the very end of the lesson, gathering it in and then making a decision about what type of plenary to do can be a really powerful tool. And yeah, I love a bit of foreshadowing, especially on a Friday lesson before they come back on a Monday. You can see which children have given it plenty of thought over the weekend and which children, oh, it's a surprise to them that this thing has come on. Oh, I didn't think that thing was coming, despite being told only a few days previous. So,
well, that's interesting. Just hearing about the hinge question there, I'm wondering if we can sort of discuss what really makes a good hinge question. How can they be used effectively? Because I feel again that you can probably spend a bit of time and get this wrong and not get the sort of return that you want. So, in terms of its construction, in terms of when perhaps you employ the hinge question, and then maybe that leads to a broader chat about checking for understanding and checking for knowledge. And I know we've talked a little bit about many whiteboards, but I wonder what else there is in that realm to explore.
I mean, hinge questions or just checking for understanding?
I mean, hinge questions first and then wider.
I think from my point of view with hinge questions, they're really hard to get right. And it's much easier to write a poor hinge question than it is a good hinge question. And part of what makes a hinge question good or not is when it's asked. You know, the point at which are children able to self-explain their idea or to recognise whether there's a pattern or a generalisation to be made. If we ask that question too early, the child might not be in a position of knowing, so they might be more in a position of guessing. From this point of view, I'm thinking about hinge questions as either a multiple choice style question with, kind of obvious distractors and potential misconceptions, or as something dialogic, an agree, disagree, or an always, sometimes, never type question. So from my point of view, the teacher has to have a really clear idea in their mind what they expect the children to be able to reason about at that stage in their understanding. If the teacher's not clear whether the children might be able to demonstrate their understanding well, it's probably not the time to ask the hints question. But I think having a good bank of resources, a place to go, you know, for from a primary point of view, if a school uses White Rose, then they can use the diagnosticquestions.com/White Rose question sets. Craig Barton's website, you know, they're well-constructed multiple choice questions, right answer, obvious distractor, misconception or calculation error type approach. Yeah, and timing those well within a learning sequence can pay real dividend to the teacher.
So let's say you had a sort of set of slides on a PowerPoint for your lesson, and you sort of stuck the hinge question in there at slide six. That's you'd probably advise against that, and you'd rather have that hinge question just up your sleeve, ready to unleash when you felt it was appropriate.
Yeah, maybe. I think I've done it in the past where my hinge question is the very last slide and I drag it into the lesson at the point at which I think it's going to be appropriate. Yeah. Or, you know, you've got it on a flip chart paper waiting to be revealed. You know, and the children might never see it that lesson because it's too early and you reveal it the next day instead. But, yeah, sometimes it's that knowing, isn't it? And you're taking in that information and deciding, is now the time to ask?
So it's interesting because it's come back again. Our conversation's come back again to reading the signals and making the decisions. And you know, it's like, how do you know when? What is it that in the lead up to this hinge question, or the what is it in the run up to the unveiling that made you decide now's the time? What sort of things are we looking for in a class or from the pupils?
How settled and how buzzy or how chatty they are, I think, is part of it, because you get a feel, don't you, for the way the atmosphere or the volume in the room is, you know, the difference between on task, that quiet, productive buzz of the person talking, but it's on task talk, versus that either they are completely off task, talking about something completely different, or maybe they're just not engaging at all, they've zoned out. I think that's definitely part of it. It's that reading the temperature of the room, isn't it?
Yeah, and looking out for those, oh, it's just this moment, you know, that happens at every age of learning, where they go, oh, today it's just this thing, and you're thinking, yeah, I just told you that in the learning objective. I told you it was just this thing, but now they're making sense of it and they're looking to their partner like, have you noticed it's just this thing as well? And that's the point to then check and go, are they talking about the thing I want them to be thinking about, or have they made a gross overgeneralization? You know, yeah, the example I was working on with the teacher was adding fractions with the same denominator. So at that point you want to make sure it's not, oh, you just add the numerators and add the denominators. You know, time out. Let's have a look at this question and see what we think.
Do you have to ask the hinge question to everybody at the same time?
No.
Cool.
I guess it depends how much guided group work you do, doesn't it? You know, in primary we're forever doing guided group work. So, you know, you might have a group of pupils and you realise they're ready for it. But again, that all comes down to classroom organisation, personalities in the group, all of those myriad things that you have to deal with.
Yeah, because I was thinking I probably have a question when they're doing a question set, I probably have one of the questions in mind and then something based around that question that when I spot they're on it, I'll go and sort of peer over their shoulder and then go grab a whiteboard and go, and what do you make of this? And sort of do it sort of maybe in the pairs they're sat in, and you know, if everyone's getting to about the same question at the same time, that might go with the question with the whole class, but actually it's a bit more of a, I'm just checking where everybody is as walk around the room, and then just sort of grab a whiteboard and go, actually I'm going to ask you this question now, and sort of stand and listen to them while they talk through it, sort of thing, rather than everybody in one go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, we're coming towards the last 5 minutes of my upper bound of how this stream should be. I know teachers are towards the end of term, we are absolutely knackered, especially for the second term. So it's great that you joined us in such short notice as well. So yeah, I suppose to round it off, I'll kind of give it over to you, Stuart, if you have any last thoughts you want people to think about or take away or whatever. Yeah.
Well, that's very kind of you, Atul. I was hoping you would be taking notes and summing up here, or perhaps producing a nice sketch note. I think we've had so many so many great little comments and insights here. Lovely chatting to you all this evening, really great. And I feel that we've probably posed a few more questions. I think we've had a go at answering things as well, but it does seem like highly effective teaching is something that develops. It's like a bit of a craft. It does seem to be something that evolves over time. And there might be some fast tracks. I think the responsibility lies with those effective teachers to try and nurture and help newer teachers on board. And yeah, they're going to have to go through the trials here and there, but I'm sure that we can actually support and help them along the way. And we've definitely come back to this idea of responsiveness. I think, you know, all teachers need to know that they are the professional, they are the ones that can make the decisions about where we go with the learning. And if you're always doing, I think Tom put it really nicely, just checking what they already know, are they ready for the new maths? If not, you need to do something about that first. There's no point building on shaky foundations. And I think as long as teachers know that it's okay to stop the chase through the scheme of work and take a moment to sort of consolidate before moving on. But something that I was think I'll probably just finish on is, like, I also think that highly effective teaching, when we see it doesn't look like a burnt out teacher. Now that's a really important thing to remember. It's not just putting in 60 plus hours a week and trying to make really nice sort of looking PowerPoints and worksheets and things like that. That's really important as well. You know, you might be getting through a lot with your classes, and it might be that they're getting some good results. But if it's coming at the expense of you, your physical health or your mental health, then it's not highly effective teaching. And I think that's really important to keep that in mind all the time.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose that roundup is let's keep these conversations going. I think we are, as learners and teachers, we are all social creatures. And once we are in a network of people who live and breathe maths teaching, I think we absorb knowledge from others just by having these conversations. And if you are watching this live or recording, please do keep it going and throw out your questions. Do appear on, go to maths conferences. There's obviously the LaSalle ones. To just give the LaSalle curriculum a plug as well, Stuart. I believe that Map of Mathematics is available for free, right? For everyone, really.
Yep, absolutely. Just go to completemaths.com and then you can create a free account, which will give you access to the whole of our curriculum, where you can have a look at the beautiful 3D realization, which shows all the threads and how all the granules of maths are connected. And you can also, of course, get a look at Tutor, which I've been working on that for almost a year now. We've created such a phenomenal tool there for teachers. It's incredible. And so you can have a look around that for free as well. So completemaths.com, the curriculum's there. You know, there's pages and pages of misconceptions and pedagogical notes and things. All of that's available. And maybe that's somewhere that, you know, early careers teachers would want to look. All of that available for free, you know, to help us build that subject knowledge and that pedagogical knowledge, so we can, you can aspire to that highly effective teaching we've been talking about.
That's brilliant. I would recommend free, everyone just grab it. I've been on that for 3-4 years. It's an incredible knowledge map. It's really, really fantastic. So yeah, I'll wrap it up there. I'll hit the stop stream button and then we'll just have a quick chat.